evening. So we've come to everybody's favorite subject. Emptiness. Page 110. Or at least, if not favorite, probably the most essential concept in Zen. Well, let's read first.
Emptiness. When you study Buddhism, you should have a general house cleaning every month. If you want to study Buddhism, it is necessary for you to forget all about your preconceived ideas. To begin with, you must give up the idea of substantiality or existence. The usual view of life is firmly rooted in the idea of existence. For most people, everything exists. They think whatever they see and whatever they hear exists. Of course, the bird we see and hear exists. But what I mean by that may not be exactly what you mean. The Buddhist understanding of life includes both existence and non-existence. The bird both exists and does not exist at the same time. We say that a view of life based on existence alone is heretical. If you take things too seriously, as if they existed substantially or permanently, you are called a heretic. Most people may be heretic.
When you say true existence comes from emptiness and goes back again into emptiness, we say true existence comes from emptiness and goes back again into emptiness. What appears from emptiness is true existence. We have to go through the gate of emptiness. This idea of existence is very difficult to explain. Many people these days have begun to feel, at least intellectually, the emptiness of the modern world, or the self-contradiction of their culture. In the past, for existence, the Japanese people had a firm confidence in the permanent existence of their culture and their traditional way of life. But since they lost the war, they have become very skeptical. Some people think this skeptical attitude is awful, but actually, it is better than the old attitude.
As long as we have some definite idea about or some hope in the future, we cannot really be serious with the moment that exists right now. You may say, I can do it tomorrow or next year, believing that something that exists today will exist tomorrow. Even though you are not trying so hard, you expect that some promising thing will come, as long as you follow a certain way. But there is no certain way that exists permanently. There is no way set up for us. Moment after moment, we have to find our own way, some idea of perfection, some perfect way which is set up by someone else, is not the true way for us.
Each one of us must make his own true way, and when we do, that way will express the universal way. This is the mystery. When you understand one thing through and through, you understand everything. When you try to understand everything, you will not understand anything. The best way is to understand yourself, and then you will understand everything. So when you try hard to make your own way, you will help others, and you will be helped by others. Before you make your own way, you cannot help anyone, and no one can help you. To be independent in this true sense, we have to forget everything which we have in our mind and discover something quite new and different moment after moment. This is how we live in this world.
So, we say true understanding will come out of emptiness. When you study Buddhism, you should have a general house cleaning of your mind. You must take everything out of your room and clean it thoroughly. If it is necessary, you may bring everything back in again. You may want many things, so one by one you can bring them back. But if they are not necessary, there is no need to keep them.
We see the flying bird. Sometimes we see the trace of it. Actually, we cannot see the trace of a flying bird, but sometimes we feel as if we could. This is also good. If it is necessary, you should bring back in the things you took from your room. that before you put something in your room, it is necessary for you to take out something. If you do not, your room will become crowded with old, ridiculous junk.
You say, step by step, I stop the sound of the murmuring brook. When you walk along the brook, you will hear the water running. The sound is continuous, but you must be able to stop it if you want. Stop it if you want to stop it. This is freedom. This is renunciation. One after another, you will have various thoughts in your mind. But if you want to stop your thinking, you can. So when you are able to stop the sound of the murmuring brook, you will appreciate the feeling of your work. But as long as you have some fixed idea or caught by some habitual way of doing things, you cannot appreciate things in their true sense.
You seek for freedom, you cannot find it. Absolute freedom itself is necessary before you can acquire absolute freedom. This is our practice. Our way is not always to go in one direction. Sometimes we go east, sometimes we go west. To go 1 mile to the west means to go back 1 mile to the east. Usually if you go 1 mile to the east, it is the opposite of going 1 mile to the west. But if it is possible to go 1 mile to the east, that means it is possible to go 1 mile to the west. This is freedom. Without this freedom, you cannot be concentrated on what you do. You may think you are concentrated on something, but before you obtain this freedom, you will have some uneasiness in what you are doing. Because you are bound by some idea of going east or west, your activity is in dichotomy or duality. As long as you are caught by duality, you cannot attain absolute freedom, and you cannot concentrate.
Concentration is not to try harder to watch something. In Zazen, if you try to look at one spot, you will be tired in about 5 minutes. This is not concentration. Concentration means freedom, so your effort should be directed at nothing. You should be concentrated on nothing. In Zazen practice, we say your mind should be concentrated on your breathing. But the way to keep your mind on your breathing is to forget all about yourself and just to sit and feel your breathing. If you will concentrate on your breathing, you will forget yourself. And if you forget yourself, you will be concentrated on your breathing. I do not know which is first. So actually, there is no need to try too hard to be concentrated on your breathing. Just do as much as you can. If you continue this practice, eventually, you will experience the true existence which comes from emptiness.
Chogyam Trungpa always used to say, first thing you get rid of is hope. No need for hope. It just gets in the way of what's actually coming across at the moment. So much of our life is based on a kind of hope that things are going to get better, that everything is going to be different. And most of those kinds of thoughts are extraneous and take away from our ability to understand what's actually happening. I hope this person will change. That's one that we all have a lot. We are so hoping that so-and-so will change her ways and become the way we want them to be. People don't change. Or we hope, you know, the forces of government will go in a certain way, but our little hopes are just little peeps in a great big darkness. And it gets in the way of actually coping with whatever the situation is. Not only that, but we don't know if there will be a tomorrow to do things in, or next year. This is Buddha's very basic teaching, that we really don't know. And it's all very brief. it's all very... there is nothing to pin down. There is no permanent anything. I know a man who was very materialistic and very kind of selfish and strong-willed. He really loved his wife, and she became ill very suddenly and passed away very suddenly. And at first he was totally devastated. And then he kind of woke up and he said, I'm going to die. Wow. We're all going to die, just like that. And it completely changed his life. He felt a freedom. I think this freedom that Roshi is talking about here, the freedom that comes from not holding on to anything, of letting things be the way they are, rather than trying to force them into some kind of mold. We don't want to go there. We'd rather create beautiful stories, heavenly realms, and yet we just tie ourselves down with those beautiful stories. We actually lock ourselves up in them often. The truth of things is, as they say, what makes us free. And the truth of things, in many ways, is what we hunger for, even though we try so hard not to see too much of it at once. Not long ago, I talked to a young mother who was just getting interested in Zen, and she had some questions about how to raise children and have a life in Zazen at the same time, which is something I've spent my whole life thinking about and living. And one of the things I said was that our children don't belong to us, that our children pass through our lives, and that we have the wonderful privilege of taking care of them and loving them, but they don't belong to us. They belong to the world. And she said that she was very moved by that, but she told her husband, and he was horrified. He said, "How can you say that? How can you say they're not your children?" And didn't really understand. I think we all go in and out of that not understanding, that we become engaged and strongly involved, emotionally involved with people and things, and begin to solidify and hold on to what they are, not seeing how ephemeral they are, not willing to let them move as they move. Michael told me on the phone today that he heard that one definition of faith is instant action. That's very interesting, that it means not thinking first, but trusting this part and this part. There's a quote that I've been carrying around for a while by Wang Po, who said, the fool gets rid of phenomena, not the mind. The sage gets rid of the mind and not phenomena. We think when we have a spiritual practice that we're trying to transcend the world and that we enter this wonderful life of the mind, the spiritual life. But Buddha's insight was that the phenomenal world is, you could say, is the mind. So we don't have to get rid of the phenomenal mind. What gets in our way is how many ideas we have about it, as well as the actual experience of it. And so we come back over and over and over again to this subject of just the experience. How does it feel? That's what he says about breathing, about zazen. If you come back to your breath, come back not to the idea of the breath or the idea of me breathing, but just feel it. As Buddha said, sometimes it's long and sometimes it's short. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's tense, and it keeps changing. Another word for emptiness is contingency. I think of contingency as meaning everything is touching everything else. Everything is contingent on everything else. No life, no existence, no even little thing can exist all by itself. We are co-created by everything else. There is no separation at all. The idea of emptiness as a kind of vacuum can make us dizzy in a certain way. But that isn't what emptiness means. It means contingency. That we are co-created by each other. Our life is a co-creation of the whole thing. And that's a dizzying thought, too, another way. It's a wonderfully dizzying thought. And coming to this practice, we can experience it as we sit. As we sit, we do forget ourselves. We do experience our life as breath. As feeling. Before you make your own way, you cannot help anyone. And no one can help you. To be independent in this true sense, we have to forget everything which we have in our mind and discover something quite new and different moment after moment. So our independence, paradoxically, and living in the world is based on how utterly connected we are. So if we empty our closets, love that image, empty our room of all the junk, all the many ideas we have about how things should be. Remember Coben's phrase, there's no should be kind of thing. Put those things away and see what is. How it is. Moment after moment. So I suppose we're all heretics. We all take it too seriously. We want it to be more solid than it really is. But every now and then something happens to us and we see through it. Not as dramatically as the man I know who lost his wife, but sometimes we just are struck by how precious things are because they are so precarious. I think we don't love the world less with this kind of mind, but more. More, because it's always passing through, as we are. So precious and so poignant. Are there questions?
Could you relate the story again about the long and the short of Buddha? You said some story about things being long and short.
The breath.
The Satipatthana Sutra. That was the first teaching he did after he did his first teaching. And what he said about the breath was just to notice it. And if it's a long breath, notice it's a long breath. And if it's a short one, notice it's a short
one. It's interesting. I read that wonderful book by Ushiyama Roshi, and he quotes Wu Jing, Dogen's teacher in China, as being quoted as saying, when the student asks some other ancient master, what do you do with the breath? And this ancient master said, let the long ones be long and let the short ones be short.
Uh-huh.
What I think is interesting about that is the second version of the story, like, pinpoints our difficulty, that it's, we can't let things be.
Yes.
The Buddha's word is somewhat more, something that I've noticed, it's more neutral. Letting is kind of like, it gets right to the heart of, well, I want it my way. Even my own breath can't be just long and just short.
Yeah.
And the Buddha's word is so beautifully neutral. It's just watch it or notice it. And I like that. I like the contrast of the two words. It kind of highlights the difficulty even with something that simple. That's a killer, right?
Now, what drives it, whether it's the self that's driving it or yes. When Buddha says those, gives those directions, but after each one he says, to be ardent and self-controlled. So it's not that you're just completely relaxing into it. It's more alertness than that. And I like the word ardent. I think that's great for it, because it means you bring your whole self into your whole self. So it's maybe even more subtle than that. But I've been thinking lately about this, about self-control and not self-control, you know, in Advaita, some Hindu religions say it's all the play of God, and so we have nothing to do with it. We just enjoy whatever happens, and everything that happens is part of that play. I was thinking of Martin Luther, who was enlightened in the latrine. So he suddenly realized that bodily functions were beyond his control. And he said, "Oh, God is doing this too," he said. So it's a very interesting way of looking at the way things are, how things work. And of course we think it's me and mine that's doing everything, but those of us who've had a baby know, you know, you get taken over by nature sometimes and you have nothing to say about it at all. It's a great power that works through your body, and actually that power is working through us all the time. Yeah.
You were talking about hope in the beginning. So I don't know if you have any commentary about, I don't know, just about anything about why, I mean, some, maybe it's like just this other religion is that right? Is that Christianity is focused on hope and it's just a different way of looking at things?
I think it is a cultural thing. It certainly is. Very big in Christianity. One hopes for heaven, you know, hopes to be reunited with everyone in heaven, and that's a very big one. And I think hope is consoling for people. It takes the sting out of life. But it also takes the truth out of life, so that you end up living in a kind of dream. You know, if you're not going to tell people that you can't help them when you can't help them, and send them off with the idea that you can even when you can't, which is what you are struggling with, then you're creating a dream world for them, and it's based on a lie. So it doesn't make sense, really. You know, even logically it doesn't make sense. Why would you tell people? You'd want them to feel better. But sometimes we have to, you know, our feelings are based on the actual situation that we're in, if we're asking for help.
It's just really bad.
Yeah, yeah. It's a natural sort of compassionate effort, which is why you went, I think, because you responded to that idea that, oh, I can go and help the, and then that you find that sometimes you can't, and you're not allowed to not be able to help them. Yeah, it's curious.
Do Buddhists believe that people can change? Do we believe in transformation? Or are we really dismal?
I think the emphasis in this practice is on our own change, not on other people's. You know, our tendency is to project and say, I want that person to change and be the kind of husband that I want or something, or the kind of teacher that I want or the kind of whatever. And Buddhism says, you know, that's a waste of time. And that's what Roshi is saying here too, that it's we work on ourself and come to terms with ourself and find how it is that we like ourself. And from that place, then we can be with other people. So the transformation comes from right here.
So can we offer anything to people that express a desire to change?
Our support, our enthusiastic support, if we know the means of it, to offer that. You know, one of the precepts is no withholding materials or teachings. So we can be, you know, offer whatever we have to offer. Teach whatever we can teach. And each of us is a teacher. So we can do that. But it's tricky, because trying to help other people is a very tricky business.
Yes.
As we all know. So, you know, we do the best we can. But what does he say? When you try hard to make your own way, you will help others and you will be helped by others. Before you make your own way, you cannot help anyone, and no one can help you. Did you have a question?
It seems like hopelessness is the same kind of mistake as hope as
yes,
well.
Yes.
Because we're dealing from like moment
yes.
to moment.
Yes.
And so it's like in a chess game, let's say you make a move and you oh no, it's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I've had this happen in games. The person doesn't see the mistake and makes another move, but like I was so busy freaking out about the mistake, I didn't respond to his move
yes.
in the right manner.
Yes.
So it's like this, like, you just got to keep walking that rope and trying to keep your mind as open as possible as to any kind of, I don't know, conclusion that has not happened.
Exactly, Julian, and that's what he means by concentration. It doesn't mean focusing on one little point. It means keeping your mind open so that you know what's going on and can respond. Exactly. Well said. It's hard, though, because we're so jumpy.
We're following, like, a lot of, like, ideologies that half the time we're not even...
Yeah.
Sure, because like when you're stuck in it, you don't even know. I mean,
yes.
Something like chess, like games in general, are pretty good at helping you determine that kind of thing.
How you actually react to
yeah.
things, yes.
Because
yeah,
there's a constant, you know, there's rules, and so it's very concrete about.
You learn a lot about yourself.
But in the world, I mean, it.
Yes, it's harder. Just play a few games of Monopoly and you learn a lot about yourself. Well, I think it's 8. Yes, it is.